Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is November 10th, 2024, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Spooky Scary Access, IV or IO for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. And our guest skeptic is Missy Carter. She is a PA currently practicing in critical care after having attending the University of Washington's MedX program. An alumnus of Tacoma Community College paramedic program, Missy serves as a paramedic for the Bremerton Fire Department for nearly 12 years and has been involved in paramedic education for 20 years. Missy has been teaching airway management for over a decade and is the creator of the pre-hospital emergency airway course, which is taught throughout Washington State. Welcome back to the SGEM, Missy.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be back.
Well, you picked a super scary theme song for today's episode. Why'd you do that song?
Well, this paper was actually published on October 31st, so it's a Halloween paper.
Yeah, can you believe it? This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine October 31st, and here we are 10 days later. We've downloaded the article, we've read the article, we've critically appraised the article, and we put together some good foaminess. So this is pretty cool. Certainly, we've cut the KT window down from over 10 years.
To only 10 days. Pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? All right, well, I'm sitting in a hotel room in São Paulo, Brazil, waiting to fly home. I've been down here to finish off part of my executive MBA at the Ivy School of Business at Western University. Have you ever been to South America?
I haven't, but it's definitely on my bucket list.
Oh, definitely. You should come down here. Great food, great people. Rio was fantastic with a great beach. Lots to see here. But people aren't here to listen to my travel plans or my travel adventures. They're here to listen to a case.
So let's start with the case. Let's say you're doing a ride-along with your local emergency medical services crews. You're responding to an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. After starting CPR, you note pulseless electrical activity on the monitor. The paramedic is trying to get IV access to give some epinephrine per protocol. She's struggling to find a good vein, so she asks you what you think about going straight to an interosseous access.
Well, out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, or the OCAs, remain one of the most challenging and time-sensitive emergencies faced by pre-hospital and emergency medicine teams, with a survival rate to discharge often in the single digits. Now, the need for rapid and effective interventions is important to improve patient outcomes.
Epinephrine's long been a cornerstone in the management of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Multiple studies have demonstrated how the administration of epi can give short-term outcomes, such as return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC. However, the evidence regarding the impact on long-term survival, and especially survival with neurologic intact outcomes, is pretty mixed. Studies like the Paramedic 2 trial have raised questions about whether epinephrine's benefits in achieving ROSC are offset by the potential adverse effects for neurologic recovery. This was covered in SGEM number 238.
Yeah, in that episode, we reviewed the Paramedic 2 trial and showed that, yes, you got more ROSC and more survival, but you didn't get more survival with good neurologic function, unfortunately. And one critical consideration in the pre-hospital epinephrine administration is the method of access. Now, IV or intravenous administration, that's been the preferred route, but securing an IV in the field can be a real challenge. Interosseous or IO access provides an alternative route in these challenging clinical scenarios. However, there has been limited research comparing the efficacy of an IO versus an IV of epinephrine in terms of both survival and good neurologic function in OCA patients.
So given these complexities, ongoing research continues. We want to explore the most effective methods of delivering epinephrine to optimize outcomes. Recent randomized trials are now evaluating whether the speed and reliability of an IO access site will provide significant benefits over our traditional routes of IV. Most EMS agencies are choosing the proximal tibia as their go-to site for IV access. The current evidence has not given us a definitive answer as to which site is best for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And Missy, you know me, I'm a skeptic. And so if we don't have good evidence that epinephrine works, I'm skeptical that it'll really matter how we give a medication that hasn't been demonstrated to show superiority for a patient-oriented outcome of benefit. But that doesn't mean I'm a denialist or a nihilist. I'm a skeptic. So if there's good data, there's good data, and I will accept it. So what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's show?
We'd like to know, should we give an IV first or should we go for an IO approach to deliver epinephrine in adult patients in out-hospital cardiac arrest?
And what's this reference from Halloween?
Cooper et al., the Paramedic 3 trial, a randomized clinical trial of drug route in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, was published October 31st, 2024 in the New England Journal of Medicine.
All right, let's go through the PCOT. What was the population in this trial?
So we're looking at adult patients over the age of 18 who experienced an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and required IV access for drug administration during the CPR.
And the intervention was?
The IO first approach.
Yeah, so the standard approach is using an IV in most protocols, as you said. So the intervention, the difference in this case was they were going to go to IO. And then I assume they compared it to the traditional IV approach?
IV first was the comparison.
All right, let's go through the outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
Primarily, they wanted to know survival at 30 days.
Yeah, so they were looking at 1 month survival. All right, and for secondary outcomes, they were looking at return of spontaneous circulation or ROSC at any time or sustained ROSC. They also wanted to know the length of stay in the hospital, if patients survived a hospital discharge and at 3 months and 6 months, and then of course, how were they neurologically on a modified Rankin scale at discharge 3 months and 6 months? And then they did a health-related quality of life questionnaire. What type of study was this?
It was multicenter, it was non-masked, and it was randomized.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, among adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest requiring drug therapy, the use of an interosseous first vascular access strategy did not result in higher 30-day survival than an intravenous first strategy, end of quote. Well, Missy, this is not your first SGEM rodeo, so you know we're going to run through a quality checklist. You ready to go?
I'm ready for it.
Okay, the first question we always have is, are these the patients we see? So from my perspective, are these emergency department patients?
No, these are my people, Ken. This is a pre-hospital study.
Yeah, and so if the first question was, are these pre-hospital patients, the answer would, of course, be yes. Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, they randomized them by agency at a one-to-one ratio.
And did they conceal the process of which they were randomizing?
Yes, they concealed it the good old-fashioned way with sealed in numbered opaque envelopes, and they were only opened when the patient was confirmed to be eligible for the trial.
I just wish that, you know, there's got to be an app for that. They've got to be able to do this electronically as opposed to having, opaque, sealed, numbered envelopes. But that's minor. All right. So the patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
They sure were. This was an intention to treat protocol.
And did they recruit patients consecutively?
They did.
And were the patients in both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, their baseline characteristics, including age and sex, whether the arrest was witnessed or not, and initial cardiac rhythm were comparable in both groups as they made adjustments for the variables in the analysis.
And then when it came to the participants, the patients, the clinicians, the outcome assessors, were they all unaware or were they masked to group allocation?
No, this was actually open label. So the assessors were aware as well of the groups the patients were allocated to.
And certainly the operators, the EMS personnel, the paramedics, they would know whether they were starting an IV first or an IO first. The patients may not have been aware because they were in cardiac arrest, but they may have been aware.
That's a hard one to blind for the EMS providers.
Yeah, it really is. Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yeah, all of the interventions were equal except for the type of access.
Yeah, so they went IO or IV, and then otherwise everything was equal. How about the follow-up? Was it complete?
It was lovely at 99.7%.
All patient important outcomes, do you think they were considered?
Yes, 30-day survival was the primary outcome and neurointact was the secondary, although I think neurointact would probably be a better primary outcome.
Yeah, I think if you ask patients what they prefer, alive or dead, versus good neurologic function or not, I think they may have picked that secondary outcome. But we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in the Talk Nerdy section. How about the treatment effect? Was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Unsure about this. The trial was planned for 15,000 people to detect a 1% difference, but the trial was stopped early due to inadequate funding. The decision was made by the investigators, who were not aware of the results. They go on to say that the effect estimates for the primary outcome were still stable, so they don't think that more recruitment would have changed the outcome.
All right, and how about the funding and financial conflicts of interest?
The National Institute for Health and Care Research funded the trial. No financial conflicts of interest were disclosed by the authors.
All right, let's dig into the results here. Data were available for analysis in just over 6,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients, and they were pretty evenly split with about 3,000 in both IO and IV groups. The mean age was 68 years, two-thirds were male, and 79% of the events happened at home. 20% of the patients had an initial shockable rhythm, and just over a third were witnessed arrest with bystander CPR performed in 70% of cases. Missy, what was the key result?
There's no statistical difference in 30-day survival rates between the IV and the IO groups.
All right, let's give them some actual numbers for that primary outcome, and I'll remind listeners, this was 30-day survival or one-month survival. What did they find?
The difference was 4.5% versus 5.1%, which was not statistically different.
All right, and how about the secondary outcomes? They were looking at return of spontaneous circulation.
That's right. ROSC was 36 versus 39%, and adjusted mean differences made these not statistically significant.
And there was also no statistical difference in survival to hospital discharge and favorable outcome or hospital length of stay. All right, my favorite part. I get to talk nerdy with you, Missy. Have you been looking forward to this?
Absolutely. Always my favorite part of your podcast is the nerdy bits.
It was nice that you wore your big black glasses. You just need to put a little bit of white tape in the middle there just to sell it a bit more on a podcast.
I try to push them up as often as possible when I'm making important points.
Nice, nice. All right, let's go through the 5 points that we want to make. And the first one was exclusions. Almost 4,000 patients were excluded from the trial because they already had vascular access. The authors suspect it was because the paramedics who were not trained in the protocol arrived first. And this could have introduced a few potential biases. So let's go through those. The first one is a potential form of selection bias. Excluding patients with pre-existing vascular access may have inadvertently selected patients who had longer response times or who were in areas where trial-trained paramedics could arrive first. This could mean the sample is less representative of typical OCA cases, affecting the trial's external validity and limiting its applicability across diverse emergency settings.
Next was a survival bias. If pre-existing vascular access correlated with faster intervention times, excluding these patients might remove a subset who could have had better outcomes due to quicker initial treatment. This exclusion could underestimate the benefits of the tested interventions if such patients typically have higher survival rates.
Yeah, and I think if memory serves me correctly, from time of dispatch to time of drug delivery, I think it was 24 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so these may have been, you know, there may have been a survival bias that the people who had vascular access were excluded because by the time they got enrolled in the study or whatever. And so you may have been looking at giving a medication 24 minutes into an arrest or longer, of course, because obviously they were arresting before they called. And that could have impacted it, so it wouldn't have worked. And this gets to the third one, and this is about spectrum bias. And this is by excluding patients who already had vascular access, and you can see how these things all overlap. The trial may have skewed the participants' spectrum, impacting the intervention's observed effectiveness. Now, spectrum bias can distort study outcomes if a proportion of the patient population with a specific characteristic like, hey, they already had IV access, is systematically excluded. So we need to be careful about some of these biases that may have been baked in to the fact that 4,000 patients were excluded and 6,000 patients were included.
Next, we move on to the second nerdy point, which is lack of masking. So the outcome assessors for this trial were aware of the group allocations. This introduces a potential for outcome assessor bias that could impact the evaluation of neurological status. We've previously discussed how there are concerns about the interrelator reliability of the modified Rankin score, even if it's done by a neurologist. Quinn et al. In 2009 reviewed 10 studies that reported overall reliability of the modified Rankin score and had a kappa of 0.46, which means it was moderate. And then they concluded, quote, there remains uncertainty regarding the modified Rankin score's reliability.
Yeah, and I know we're talking about the reliability of the modified Rankin score, but it is a bit fuzzy, right? Because of that inter-rater reliability only being moderate, but it is the standard tool. So if that's the standard tool we're using, you can expect them to be using that tool, even if it's not the greatest tool to use for neurologic status or if there's problems or limitations with it. We did mention nerdy point number three a little bit when we were talking about external validity. I think we talked about that with selection bias, but this is a different part of external validity. This study was conducted in the UK, which may limit generalizability to other emergency medical systems, which have different protocols or equipment available in the pre-hospital setting. Hinting at that there may be some external validity problems is the different patient population was the 5% survival rate in this study. Now, this is lower compared to the US, which has a survival rate of about 11%, but it is on par with the OPALS study, which we've covered on the SGEM, and the OPALS study was done by legend of emergency medicine, Dr. Ian Steele in Canada. And again, it had about a 5%. So it was in the ballpark. The survival rate in this study was similar to the survival rate reported in the Paramedic 2 trial. The low survival rate is a little odd, though, considering the high rates of bystander CPR. They had like 70% of bystander CPR, but that may have been because most of these arrests happened at home too. So maybe someone in your own family or in your own home is more likely to do CPR as a bystander than if you have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest on the street or something. Of note, though, and this is something I mentioned before, it did take them 24 minutes from the time of the call to the delivery of the epinephrine.
I mean, 70% is pretty impressive. That's the place I want to live, where 70% of people are getting bystander CPR. There were higher rates of ROSC in the IV group, even though the time to drug administration was the same. The peak time of drug concentration might have been different between the routes. The IO group was 17% humeral head and 73% proximal tibia. If this were reversed, would the outcomes be different? There's some animal studies that suggest the proximal tibia and the IV route are both slower to peak drug concentration than the proximal humerus. If these were all humeral heads, would the outcome change? A recent Taiwan trial, the Vector trial, compared IV to humeral head IO in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and they actually saw no statistical difference.
All right, so the fourth nerdy point we wanted to talk about was stopping the trial early. It was stopped early due to lower than anticipated enrollment rates. The researchers had planned to recruit 15,000 patients to achieve a sufficient power for detecting an absolute difference of 1% for survival at 30 days as their primary outcome between IO versus IV access. However, due to challenges in patient recruitment and the expiration of the funding period, the trial was concluded with approximately 6,000 patients. Stopping a trial early can have multiple effects, including reduced statistical power, wider confidence intervals, decreased robustness for secondary outcomes, and missing adverse events.
I really like that term, robustness. I always want to have increased robustness.
Yes, and I want to have robustness and gestalt.
Gestalt, one of my favorites. So the next and last nerdy point is, does epi really work anyway? So it would have been a better trial if they were able to include a placebo. This would have provided more information on whether giving this drug had a patient-oriented outcome to start with. Remember, the Paramedic 2 trial reported improved ROSC, but not survival with good neurologic outcome. They had 2.1% in the epi group versus 1.6 in their placebo. However, it may have been much more difficult to get a trial approved by an ethics committee if they were trying to use a placebo arm.
Yeah, I can understand that it would have been more challenging to have gotten ethics approval if they had included a placebo arm, but I think we would have had better information, more information, and it would have added to the Paramedic 2 trial findings as well if you had a placebo group. All right, well, it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So we agree with the author's conclusions.
Yeah, we do. And how about an SGEM bottom line, Missy?
Bottom line, there's not seem to be a meaningful difference between IV or IO access in adult patients who are in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. It might not be important because the lack of high-quality evidence that epinephrine provides a patient-oriented outcome.
All right, how about a case resolution? Because that paramedic was struggling. She was struggling to get IV access, and she's saying, hey, should I go IO?
You tell the paramedic that IV or IO seem to be similar in regards to outcomes, and it's the dealer's choice.
All right, and so how are you going to take Paramedic 3 and apply it clinically?
I think it's reasonable to choose either IV or IO access when it comes to out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. However, we should not let issues that haven't been shown to work, like IV access, epinephrine, or airway type for that matter, distract us from improving high-quality CPR and early defibrillation.
Yeah, we don't want to take our eye off the ball on things that do work. And so that means high-quality CPR and early defibrillation in shockable rhythms. And so we don't want to be distracted by going, I don't know, do you want to use a supraglottic airway, or do you want to do an endotracheal intubation, or should we go IO or IV, or should I do the IO? Should I do it in the tibia, or should I do it in the humerus? You know, really, let's just remember, focus in on that high quality CPR and early defibrillation, and then we can talk later about the other stuff, but let's really focus on what we do have evidence for. All right, so what are you going to tell the patient?
Well, hopefully you achieve not only ROSC, but also some good neurologic outcome. So we can tell the patient that they received excellent pre-hospital care.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener contest winner. I think this is a first-time win for Dr. Robert Hurst, the host of RCEM Learning Podcast in the UK. He knew the three actions to the song, If You're Happy and You Know It, are clapping your hands, stamping your feet, and shouting, Hooray! Missy, what's the question this week?
What was the first IO site ever used in resuscitation?
Ooh, I wonder if it was the tibia or the humerus. Well, if you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a big shout out on the next episode. Now, there are a number of other SGEM episodes on out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In fact, I think we have covered this more often, this topic of OCA, more often than any other topic in the 13 years that the SGEM has been going. So I'll list those in the show notes if you want to go back and listen to some of the older episodes. Hey, thanks, Missy, for coming on and getting this done so quickly, because I threw this article out to you and said, hey, do you want to do another show? And this just got published on Halloween. And you're like, yeah, let's do it. And then before we knew it, 10 days, here we are recording.
Yeah, it's really awesome to be able to get this evidence out quickly. And I can't tell you enough how excited I am about the dedication to out-of-hospital studies on the SGEM. It's really, really nice to be able to direct EMS providers to a good resource to kind of be skeptical about evidence.
And I look forward to throwing this up in the next couple of weeks. So this will probably come up later November, early December, and see what people think of it and see what other people have done and thought of how they can take Paramedic 3 and clinically apply it. Because we're never going to say, at least I hope we shouldn't be using absolutes, but we're not going to say that our way is the correct interpretation, and we want to hear what other people think as well. Because there'll be, with evidence-based medicine, you know, there's the evidence which informs our care and guides our care, but we're still going to have to use our own clinical judgment in our own practice environment. And then again, engage with our patient population and ask them what they prefer and what they value. Hence, evidence-based medicine.
It's really the beauty of practicing medicine, right? There's so many facets, but at the end of the day, you got to treat the patient in front of you with the knowledge that you have.
And that's why the EBM answer is, it all depends. And the last thing I need you to do is if you could read the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emerging Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.